You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, on this July.
Beautiful afternoon. Day.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone, and we hope that you're enjoying this beautiful day.
Yeah, we don't get too many of these in July. Sunny, bright, and under 85 degrees.
Yeah, awesome, wonderful.
So, Mom, who do we have with us today on Writer's Voices?
Today we have a gentleman, Alan Mendenhall, and he is the Associate Dean and Executive Director of the Blackstone and Burke Center for Law and Library at Faulkner University, and the author of Literature and Liberty, Essays in Libertarian Literary Criticism. That was in 2014. He has been featured in Forbes, U.S. News and World Report, Newsweek, The American Spectator, Los Angeles Review of Books, and more. He has appeared on BBC World News, Al Jazeera, and Alabama Public Television, and has a monthly show on Fox News, affiliate WFPA, 1400 AM. He's the editor of the Southern Literary Review, and this is his third book.
And welcome to Writer's Voices, Alan.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Where are you calling us from today?
I am calling in from Montgomery, Alabama, which is where the law school where I'm employed is located.
And have you lived your whole life in Alabama?
No, I have not. I've lived in Alabama since 2013. My mom is from a little town called Opelika, Alabama, and my dad is from Columbus, Georgia, and those are both pretty close to the Alabama-Georgia line near Auburn. And they both moved to Atlanta when they were in the eighth grade, didn't know each other. Then they went to the same junior high school in the eighth grade and met each other and actually dated and went to rival high schools. They broke up after a month, went to rival high schools but sort of knew each other, and then they reconnected as freshmen at Auburn University and started dating and got engaged before they graduated and got married after they graduated. So I'm sort of returning back to my roots a little bit by returning to Alabama.
And Auburn University is a big part of your family's roots, according to one of the essays in here.
It is. Yeah, my mom's family is the Glynn family, and the Glynn family was instrumental in the founding of East Alabama Mail College, which was the predecessor to Auburn University. Auburn's a land, sea, and space grant university, but it began as a land grant university, and it was Alabama Polytechnic Institute, before it became Auburn University in the 1960s. And so my family history runs all the way back to the beginning of Auburn. I actually live in Auburn now and work in Montgomery, and those two cities are about an hour apart.
And you received your PhD in English from Auburn University.
I did. I received my PhD in English at Auburn, which ensured that I got written into the family will.
Well, you took the long way around on that road, didn't you?
Well, I tell you what, I'm not sure if my brother's even in it, because when he was a freshman in college, we went to an Auburn Georgia Tech game, my dad and I did, and we sat up in the upper deck, and my brother was a freshman at Georgia Tech, and Auburn played Georgia Tech, and Georgia Tech won that game. We watched my brother jump over the fence and storm the field, and my dad was none too happy. So I actually am very happy that occasion took. I may get my brother's portion of the will after that.
Oh, wow. So, Alan, how did this book of Bees and Boys, Lines from a Southern Lawyer, is the book we're discussing today. We usually give the title right up front.
Yeah.
It's Of Bees and Boys. It is a book of essays, a fairly slim book of essays, not too challenging to get through. And all of these essays had been published elsewhere previously, correct?
That's correct, yeah. I didn't have any idea that I was writing a book. Obviously, I was just writing essays for personal reasons and sending them out to different magazines and different journals, and they were getting published. And at some point, the publisher, Red Dirt Press, contacted me and said, hey, do you have enough essays to for us to compile as a book? We'd really like to publish some of your personal essays. We've come across them in different magazines, and we'd be really interested in that. And I said, I honestly don't know. Let me see. And so I went back and looked at some of the essays I'd published in recent years and got back to them and said, well, I have these. What do you think? And they said, perfect. We'd love to publish them as a book. And so that's sort of how the book came together. Interestingly enough, there's enough of a through line between the essays that they fit together fairly well as a single text. But the essay itself is such a meandering form as it is that it sort of lends itself to these kinds of compilations.
Do you think that's very common that the publisher contacts an author, or isn't always usually the way around?
Yeah, that's kind of an easy publishing, getting published story there, Alan.
Well, we don't
hear too many of those.
I don't know how common that is, but I was certainly grateful for it. It wasn't actually something that had crossed my mind that I might be able to pull them together as a book. So when the publisher sort of put that little seed in my mind and it started to germinate and flower into something, I was actually really excited that there would be another book and all that.
Now, did you have other essays that didn't make it into the book, or is this a complete collection of the essays of Alan Mendenhall?
Well, it's not a complete collection. I have a couple essays that didn't quite fit, but having gone through this process, I sort of realized those essays, because they fit with each other, may be able to form the basis of some other future book of essays. We'll see.
Okay.
Well, I'm curious what it was about those that made them not fit with this, and in part, in answering that, maybe describe kind of what the overall theme of this book would be.
Sure. Well, the overall theme is basically the need to sort of slow down and examine life and such concepts as place and reading and literature and family and custom and tradition. And I've been told from virtually everyone who's read the book that death is a major theme of the book. And I have to admit, I think that's true, although I didn't consciously set out to write about death. It is a central feature of the book, and so many of my essays deal with it. The first essay, for example, is about my brother and me killing a bunch of bees when we were young. We used to kill these bees that lived in our swing set and make bee soup out of them. And our efforts were thwarted one day by yellow jackets. We actually tried to harass the yellow jackets by putting a stone over their tunnel. They sort of purred in and out of this hole in the ground. And Jared, my friend at the time, put a stone over the hole, and we thought we were blocking the yellow jackets' passage and sort of entombing them in there, and we gave each other high fives and we laughed and all that kind of stuff. But we had no idea that the bees were smarter than we were, and they had tunneled a secret passageway, and there was another hole on the other side of the yard. And before we knew it, a cloud of yellow jackets just sort of enveloped us and started stinging with fatalistic purpose. And we found ourselves running and screaming. And my brother was too young to climb the fence, so he got kind of stuck on the fence. And there were yellow jackets in his ears and in his clothes, and my mom had to run out and rescue him. So there were lessons in that experience. And then there are other essays that deal with, for example, my cancer diagnosis when I was in my young 20s, and talking about the memories of my grandfather before he passed away, and talking about a possum that when I was young I attempted to kill as a young child, and trying to make sense of that story, why I would have done that when I was so young, what would have possessed me to try to do that. So it is, I think death is one of those inevitabilities that we all face, and it's one of the commonalities we share as human beings. And too often in this era, we like to, you know, compartmentalize it, push it off to the side, pretend it doesn't exist. We almost train ourselves into delusion that it's not going to happen to us. And I don't like that. I like to think about it and to try to make sense of it and come to terms with it, because it is a reality. And so some of that does come through in the book.
So the theme of this book is life and death. And what about the other two essays didn't fit into that?
Well, yeah, because I guess everything that happens between life and death experience, right? So you would think that would be a pretty broad category. Well, one of the essays that didn't make it in was on Harper Lee's book, Go Set a Watchman. And I know there's a chapter in here about Harper Lee. Actually, the chapter that's about my grandfather is also about Harper Lee, because he grew up with her and with Truman Capote and had a lot of stories to share about that experience. And the reason I thought it didn't quite fit is because the purpose of that essay was somewhat different. The purpose of that essay was to reflect on Harper Lee's rendering of Atticus Finch, the sort of controversial rendering of him that is at odds with his portrayal in To Kill a Mockingbird. My argument in that essay is actually that the two Atticus Finches aren't actually so separate as we might think, that the Atticus Finch of To Kill a Mockingbird and the Atticus Finch of Go Set a Watchman could very easily be the same person in a historical situation, that we don't have to think of them as two people, even if they are two characters of two different novels, that it wouldn't be impossible for someone like that to have existed. And then some of the other essays I thought were more about literary canon, literary tradition, and things like that, that are somewhat more historical, philosophical, rather than just the personal essay format.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Alan Mendenhall, author of Bees and Boys, Lines from a Southern Lawyer. And Alan is also the editor of the Southern Literary Review and teaches at a law school. So that's kind of an unusual combination, isn't it? A lawyer who writes literary criticism?
Well, I suppose it is. I mean, there can't be very many of them out there. I know lawyers tend to write a lot. Doesn't necessarily mean that what they're writing is all good, but I've heard it said that a lawyer writes more in his or her career than a novelist does, and that probably is true as far as the sheer amount of emails and memoranda and briefs and all the writing that goes into practicing law. But I think the two professions lend themselves well to each other. I think part of being a good lawyer is being able to tell a good story, whether you are briefing a case or presenting an argument before a jury. You need to tell a story, and in that respect, I think the two professions are complementary.
That's right. The first essay about the bees and the boys, isn't it interesting that those yellow jackets knew who it was that blocked their entrance?
It really is interesting, and actually, I wish I knew a lot more about insects. There's certain things in life that you want to go back and research and learn about, but you just don't have the time. Mm-hmm. And frankly, this is one of them. I took the time to write this essay, but I never took the time to go back and read why that happened. What makes yellow jackets do this? Do yellow jackets often build nests, or was this sort of a unique thing? And then there were it was a different kind of bee that was living in the swing set that we used to smack with our shovels and make little make bee soup out of.
Who did you feed the bee soup to?
Those were. Well, yeah. The bee soup basically just sat there in a bucket.
I hate to tell you this, but I think if they were bumblebees, they're probably endangered now.
They could have been. And that's sort of the tragedy of it. What was so interesting as a kid is that what bothered me, and what I talk about in the essay, is how disturbingly human the bees behaved when we killed them. the bees that we first smacked with our shovels would just be littered across the ground, little bee corpses. And then there were this second set of bees would come and pick up the dead bees and fly away with them to who knows where.
Yeah.
And, as cruel as it sounds, my brother and I would then kill the bees that were coming to perform the rescue. I don't know, maybe we just wrote it off as all bees are our enemy kind of thing, and we just wanted to kill whatever bees we saw because we perceived them all to be a threat, no matter whether they were or not. But, that's part of what writing essays involves, is trying to figure out why you did something in the past.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And to examine really the strangeness of our own personal experiences. I think essays are an attempt to organize the fragmentation and disarray of ordinary experience in our own past.
Alan, how long have you been writing essays?
That's a good question. I don't think I really know the answer to it either. I know at least since 2006 or 2007, I think that's when some of these essays first began. But I would imagine when I was young, I can recall writing a lot of stuff that was just sort of throwaway scribbling. So in that respect, I guess as long as I can remember, I've been writing. But writing at a publishable professional level has been about, a decade or so.
What, the essay format is kind of a specific format. What are sort of the general rules of writing a publishable essay?
Well, the thing I like about the essay is it sort of throws the rules out the window. I mean, in high school, when students are learning how to write, their high school teacher will tell them, okay, you need a first paragraph with a thesis statement that has three parts, and then your next three paragraphs are going to substantiate that thesis statement, and then you're going to have a conclusion, and you've wrapped it up. It's going to be nice and tidy, and that's it. That's the formula. But the essay as a genre, as a form of creative nonfiction, actually defies conventions. It's usually written with a tone and a voice that are intimate and personal, as if the author is conveying confidential information to the reader, when the reality of the situation is that the seemingly private thoughts are being broadcast to a mass audience, to any potential reader that is out there. But I think the essay is part anecdote, it's part philosophy, it's basically just thinking on paper. The great essayists like Montaigne, William Hazlitt, Charles Lamb, Wendell Berry, Thoreau and Emerson, Jonathan Franzen, and in our current moment, they all address an idea and sort of go on tangents and digressions. The essay is diversionary, and in that way, it's kind of fun to just walk through the mind of an essayist, to read along with him or her as they just explore, rather than make a conventional argument that's supposed to be succinct and cogent. The essayist, it could go in any direction. It's almost like being inside of someone's head. At any given moment, we have different tensions and different thoughts that just go all over the place. And when you're reading good essays, you get to kind of go all over the place with the author and experience it with him or her.
But the best part is that it's not book length. They're short and concise, and that's really good.
Yeah, I think that's one thing. That's one thing that's fun about collections of essays is you can, throw them down on the kitchen table and read someone's chapter here, read a chapter there, or throw it in the back of a toilet seat or something, and people can and grab it, read a chapter, and you read one chapter, you're done, and you don't miss the rest of the book. You can start at any page, start at any chapter, and read. And I think that's fun, too.
Yeah, and come back to it 6 months later, and you don't have to
come back,
try and figure
exactly
out where
you haven't missed a plot.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, Alan, I think this would be a good time to ask you to read from one of your essays so the audience can really get a feel for your essay style.
Well, thank you. I'd be happy to do that. And since we've been talking about the Bees and Boys essays, I think I'll read from that, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
Okay. My brother Brett and I were polite but rambunctious children who made a game of killing bees and dumping their carcasses into buckets of rainwater. Having heard that bees, like bulls, stirred at the sight of red, we brandished red plastic shovels, sported red t-shirts, and scribbled our faces in red marker. All these shovels, not longer than arm's length, and light too. So light, in fact, that we wielded them with ease, as John Henry wielded a hammer or Paul Bunyan an axe. The bees had a nest somewhere within the rotting wood of our swing set. Monkey bars made of metal triangles, much like hand percussion instruments, dangled from the wooden frame above. When struck or rattled with a stick, bees replied in sharp, loud tones, infuriating the bees, a feisty front line of which launched from unseen dugouts. These deployments, though annoying, were easily outmaneuvered. Brett and I swatted them to the ground with our shovel heads. Mortally wounded, they twitched and convulsed, moving frantically but going nowhere. All except one bee, valiant as he was, pathetic, wriggling toward his nearest companion, his mane posterior dragging in the dirt. Not much for voyeurism, I relieved him of his misery. Then Brett and I whacked the littered lot into tiny bee pancakes. Meanwhile, the defeated community, convening somewhere in the wood, commissioned its combat medics. Fat, steady-flying drones that hovered airborne over the dead and then descended, slow and sinking like flying saucers. The medics would, when we lit them, carry off their dead to an undisclosed location. I couldn't watch this disturbingly human ritual, so instead I annihilated the medics too. They were easy targets, defenseless, and as they kept coming in battalions of 10 or 11, as soon as I destroyed one battalion, another materialized to attend to the new dead. Unlike the frontliners, the medics didn't try to sting. They just came to collect, but I wouldn't let them. Neither would Brett. Eventually, they quit coming. That, or we kill them all. Bees are funny creatures. Unlike birds, they have two sets of wings. Most female bees, unlike most female humans I know, grow their leg hairs long and their bellies plump, just in order to carry nectar or pollen. Pollination accounts for one-third of the human food supply. Without bees, then, we might not have our Big Macs or Whoppers, nor, for that matter, honey or flowers. When I lived in Japan, I had a friend who fancied himself an entomologist. When he and I tired of talking politics, books, or women, we spoke of insects. I told him weird insect stories, and he explained away the weirdness. He informed me, for instance, that the bees living in my swing set were probably solitary bees, a gregarious species that stung only in self-defense. This, you might imagine, was sobering news for an insect murderer. I asked about the medics that carried away the dead. Honeybees, he said, discarded their dead for hygienic reasons, to prevent the spread of infection, and they coated their dead in antibacterial waxes. As for the behavior of my bees, however, he wasn't sure. Maybe they, like honeybees, discarded remains where germs couldn't spread. Or maybe, and he said this facetiously, they conducted funerals. It wasn't long before Jared, the boy next door, got in on our bee brutality. Pregnant with mischief, more so than me or Brett, he decided one day to show us something. Shepherding us through the woods, lifting a disarming smile as if to say, "Trust me," he paused at last, indicated a hole in the ground, and declared, "This is it." A steady stream of yellow jackets purred in and out of the hole. He waved his hand to signify the totality of our surroundings and said, "Ours. All ours. None for the bees," or something to that effect. Brett and I nodded in agreement, awaiting instruction. If we were confused by Jared's deranged sense of prerogative, we didn't show it. Brett found a heavy rock, which I helped him to carry. We dropped it at Jared's feet. Jared summoned a mouthful of mucus and hacked it into the hole. Unfazed, the yellow jackets buzzed in acknowledgement, but otherwise ignored the assault. "These guys are in for hell," Jared said of the bees, offended at the ineffectuality of his first strike. He anchored his feet and bent over the rock, which he heaved to his chest and, leaning backwards, rested on his belly. Then he staggered a few steps, stopped, and, his face registering another thought, dropped the rock to the ground. "Spit on it," he ordered. Brett and I, obedient friends that we were, doctored the rock and spit. Then Jared undertook to finish the job he'd begun. He bent down, lifted the rock, waddled to the hole, straddled the hole, and dropped the rock. The ground thumped. A small swirl of dust spiraled into miniature tornadoes that eventually outgrew themselves and became one with the general order of things. That'll do it, Jared said, clapping his hands together to dry the spit. The colony, its passage blocked, was trapped both inside and out. Those unentombed bees, rather than attack, simply disappeared. We rejoiced in our victory. Jared pantomimed conquest, pretending to hold an immense and invisible world, atlas-like, over his shoulders. Brett danced. I was so busy watching Jared and Brett that I can't remember what I did. We didn't know that Yellow Jacket's engineered nest tunneled hidden passageways and backup exits, nor did we appreciate what the tiny zealots were capable of. It started with trifling harassment, a slight circling buzz, reconnaissance probably. Then I felt the first sting. Looking down, I saw a Yellow Jacket curled like a question mark, bearing into my leg. I spanked it dead. It looked angry, something in the way it moved. I heard Brett scream, then Jared, then saw the ubiquitous cloud of Yellow Jackets rising in the air, moving as one unit, enveloping us with fatalistic purpose. My ears filled with the steady drone of thrumming wings. Then, as happens in moments like this, moments of panic, moments when one feels he's lost control, feels some other faculty taking over, I submitted to a greater power, which stiffened the muscles of my neck and arms, sent contractions through my calves and thighs like spasms moving me forward, making me to run. The house, my house, once far away, a small square, growing larger and larger until at last it became a complete, reachable form. The door, my safety, announcing its presence, telling me to hurry, hurry. Ahead was a fence. I'd have to jump it. I measured my strides for the leap, which, miraculously, I achieved with the slight assistance of my palms upon the fence top. I found the doorknob, dove into the kitchen, flung off my clothes. The drone wouldn't go away. But where was Brett? Not here. Where was he? Just then came a voice. Alan, what in God's name? And then Mom was beside me, horrified, her eyes growing three times their normal size. And then she was gone again. Somehow I was back at the door, looking outside of the yard, at Mom battling the fleet of Yellow Jackets, at Brett stuck on the fence top, screaming, his face flushed red, red, his arms leaking blood. Was that blood or sore? I couldn't tell. Mom deposited Brett in the kitchen, stripped him naked, called the doctor. Tweezers. I remember tweezers. Yellow Jackets were in his ears and mouth. They were everywhere. Outside, they continued ramming their bodies into the window. I looked out. One hovered there. It looked at me. I looked at it. Insect and man, sizing each other up. In light of these memories, I can't help but sense that, no, on account of their nature and characteristics, bees are not the affirmative happy creatures of some Wordsworthian lyric, that they're too much like us for armistice or reconciliation, that, in fact, we will never see the last of them. Never see the last of us. They will live on, as will we. Let the boys at them and they at the boys. That's how it ought to be. So alike are the two that it's hard to tell who has the advantage of intelligence. I learned, those many years ago, before the profundity of it all struck me, that wounds can teach the tragic lessons of ignored similarities. If nothing else, I've come to admire bees for their tenacity and courage in the face of insurmountable power. Theirs is a world of flux, disorder, and death. Their body is a weapon, one that, once used, terminates everything. Boys war with bees, bees war with boys, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, except no one can say else, not in this game. In this game, there is only one ending. Even in victory, the bees lose. It may take a man to fully understand, and it might just take bees or something like them to make a man.
That was Alan Mendenhall reading from Of Bees and Boys, Lines from a Southern Lawyer.
You know, I think really animals, insects, birds, they know they can think better than we think they can. Look at a squirrel. I mean, you know, it amazes
me. Behold the squirrel.
Why don't you write more about squirrels? Interesting creatures.
Yeah, it's interesting. And actually, I recall in the essay about my grandfather, he used to take a BB gun and shoot the squirrels off the bird feeder because he thought that the squirrels had too much of an advantage when it came to the feeder. Mm-hmm. Then one day he shot a squirrel and actually hit it, and it knocked the squirrel down, and he thought he had killed the squirrel. It was just lying there on the ground, and he went and was going to collect it or see whether it had been hurt. And then the little thing came to, shook its head, and bounded off into the woods. And my grandfather that day took his BB gun and put it back up in the closet and didn't take it out again.
Wow.
In case people are interested, squirrels do not like a certain kind of nut that I give my birds, safflower seed.
Oh, interesting.
Safflower seed. They will not touch it.
Wow.
Yeah, so I have one feeder.
That's helpful. I'm now taking notes.
No kidding. It's and they sell it at they sell it at Menards and places like that. So it was interesting. I was really tickled to find out because I have trouble with
I had bought Mama bird feeder once that was supposed to be squirrel proof.
Yeah, it is. I still use it.
Okay. It if a squirrel gets on it, it tips it over.
Yeah. And they hang on.
Oh, no. Just had a cat named Shakespeare. He met an untimely death recently, but Shakespeare would always get the birds from our feeder. I don't know how he did it. It didn't seem possible. I never actually saw him do it. I would always see little birds on our back doorstep, and they were beautiful birds. It was such a shame.
Oh.
We just sort of collected them. Eventually, we just had a bird feeder full of seed and no birds because birds were smart enough to know, don't go to that yard.
Yeah. Some people put collars with bells on the cat to warn the birds.
Is that what the bells are for?
A little bit of a Houdini as well. He would always end up losing those things, but we tried that.
Oh.
Wow. My neighbor had a cat once, and one day I looked out, and it was sitting under my bird feeder, just sitting there waiting for the birds.
Just sort of crouched down like a...
So, Alan, you know, as you mentioned, one of the essays is about Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird. How important was that book to you as a, like, growing up?
It was very important. Before I was old enough to even read it, everyone in my family talked about it because my grandfather had been raised in Monroeville, Alabama, which is where Harper Lee grew up. And he would just tell all kinds of stories about her. And I'm trying to think. I can't remember if he was a couple years older or a couple years younger. I actually say in the essay, but I just can't remember.
I think younger. I think he was a few years younger.
Heck was. But they grew up together at any rate. And so when I was old enough to read the book, it was sort of like I knew it. And I had seen the movie actually before I read the book, you know, the great film with Gregory Peck, who is the only person ever who could play Atticus Finch. Then when I read it, I enjoyed it so much that I began to read it every year, and for many, many, many years, I read that book every single year, and I've sort of fallen away over the last 4 or 5 years. I know I read it a few years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago again, but it's no longer an annual ritual, I'll put it that way.
What do you get out of it, rereading it at time after time?
You know... enjoyment. I think as we get older, we have different experiences when we come to a text, and I don't know if I come to it with different perspectives every year and different experiences that inform my reading of it, but every time I sort of read it in a different way, and I'm never bored with it. I always enjoy myself. I suppose if 1 year I pick it up and read it and I think that I'm bored, I won't do it anymore, but that never happens, so I just continue to do it. I think it's a powerful book. I think it's an underrated book, at least from a critical perspective, from professional literary critics and theorists, but most readers, I mean, it continues to still be one of the most widely sold books on the planet, so I think there are insights in that book that maybe the professional critics miss or can't appreciate or think themselves too good for. But I just find it to be a profound book and one that I can relate to on different levels, even though, you know, I grew up in a time and space that was far from the one that Scout and Jim grew up in. And I can appreciate Atticus Finch as someone who grew up to become a lawyer. In fact, if it weren't for Atticus, I probably never would have been a lawyer. And then when I went into private practice, found that law was not all noble and Atticus Finch-like. And then I think that's sort of one of the reasons why I appreciated Ghost at a Watchman, is it did sort of upset expectations and portrayed the reality of things, at least in the legal profession,
Now, Ghost at a Watchman was just published a couple years ago, correct?
That's correct,
and
yeah.
This was more than 50 years after To Kill a Mockingbird?
I believe that's correct. I don't know the exact number of how many years, but that strikes me as being at least around the right amount of time, yeah.
And it was after Harper Lee's... Was she still alive at that point?
No, she had passed away. There was some controversy about whether the book should have been published, whether she intended it to be published, you know, whether it was of the right quality, whether there was a reason why it had not been.
Mm. And I'm trying to remember, I did read it and I liked it. I don't remember exactly what it was about, other than, you know, that it was Scout, slightly older, correct? Coming.
Yeah, she's 26 in the book. And she comes back from New York, back to Macomb, Alabama. Macomb's the fictional town, which my grandfather would have told you is just a version of Monroeville, Alabama. And frankly, there's not much of a plot. I mean, the story basically involves Scout's relationship and dealings with her dad, Atticus Finch, and with her uncle Jack, and with a suitor named Henry. And she's sort of shocked about, you know, race relations in the South, shocked about the way her dad looks to her. She no longer sees him as she saw him when she was a child. Mm. And so part of the reason why I think that Ghost of the Watchman is not a bad book is that and if you put it side by side with To Kill a Mockingbird, you realize that, okay, you have this narrative that To Kill a Mockingbird is from the perspective of a child scout. Mm-hmm. Now, the actual narration of To Kill a Mockingbird is a little more complicated by the fact that it shifts and changes. But at any rate, when you get to Ghost at a Watchman, you have the more adult reality. You have an adult who's a little more jaded, a little more disenchanted, but also a much, much wiser scout who's able to see the layers of complexity to Atticus, and who's able to not elevate him to an impossible level of virtue that nobody could attain in real life. So that's why I sort of appreciate the novel. It's like William Blake's Songs of Innocence and William Blake's Songs of Experience. The Kill a Mockingbird may be the Songs of Innocence, and Ghost at a Watchman might be the Songs of Experience. That's not to say, obviously, To Kill a Mockingbird deals with very intense situation involving Tom Robinson and very fraught race complexities and challenges. But the narrator is able to, you know, color those experiences and in a way that is more childlike in To Kill a Mockingbird. And
now, if I recall,
a little bit. Sorry, go ahead.
Didn't Harper Lee, she originally wrote the Watchmen book first? There's some theory about that?
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe she wrote the Watchmen book first and couldn't get it published. And then, she started writing on the To Kill a Mockingbird. And actually, the story, as I understand it, is that when she first took the manuscript of To Kill a Mockingbird to Lippincott Publishers, they said, well, this is a nice collection of short stories, but it's not a novel. You know, go back and give it a through line, give it some sort of continuity between chapters. And so that's when the Tom Robinson part of the story came in. And I have no idea whether there's any truth to this, but the sort of legend that you hear is that Truman Capote came in at that point and helped her craft the Tom Robinson sections, or at least helped her think through that important part of the story. And that gave the book, obviously, a much graver subject matter, because it's set against the backdrop of the civil rights era. Was when the book's published. The plot takes place much earlier than the civil rights era, but the book's publication is during the civil rights era. So it gave a social element to the book that was lacking in the earlier manuscripts.
Now, in your essay, I think you refer to a possible third manuscript.
And that, I'm not the only person who has heard of this. There was a writer at the New Yorker contacted me a few years ago wanting to set up an interview and talk to me about it. And I said, look, you're talking to the wrong person. I'm doing the same thing you're doing. I'm trying to find out about this as well. And those are rumors that you hear around Alabama, that there was another book that she possibly wrote about an Alabama insurance salesman who had killed multiple wives, and that this would have been sort of what Truman Capote did with In Cold Blood. This would have been more of, it was either nonfiction or it was based on a true story. So I don't know whether that manuscript exists, but it is one of those things that among certain circles you hear whispers about. So maybe one day some scholar or some fortunate person will happen across it and we'll have another manuscript, but I just don't know for sure.
Well, you know, I can see why you would read and reread Mockingbird, because the characters, there's quite a bit of depth to the characters, although in first reading you don't catch it, but when you think about Scout and, you know, and the children in it, I don't know, it's there's something in there that you just want to know. You want to know more about them, really.
Well, I agree, and I actually think that one of the most profound scenes in all of literature, I know this is a very tall claim, but it's a very moving scene, which is when Atticus Finch is guarding the jail where Tom Robinson is locked inside, and a mob comes up. You know, we're not actually told that it's KKK, but it's implied.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell, you know, Atticus, move out of the way. They're going to go in there and lynch Tom Robinson. And Jim and Scout just sort of emerge out of nowhere and with Dill. And Jim goes and stands in front of Atticus, like, you got to get through me to get to him. Well, then Scout is so childlike and innocent that she sees in the crowd the dad of one of her peers, Mr. Cunningham, and she says, hey, Mr. Cunningham, how you doing? You know, don't you remember me? I'm friend of your boy. And
yeah.
Mr. Cunningham is so moved by that moment that he tells the rest of the crowd, all right, guys, you know, let's get out of here. And the crowd disperses. So the crowd, which would not back down to Atticus, backs down. It just, the innocent questioning of a child who doesn't realize the enormity or the gravity of that situation.
Right.
Mom, did you teach To Kill a Mockingbird in English?
No, I don't think so.
No.
But it is one of my favorite books, and I love the movie. And of course, as he says, you know,
yeah, Gregory Peck is
Peck is magnificent.
The person for that role. There couldn't be anybody else. I can't imagine any kind of remake of that movie, because no one else could be Gregory Peck. But
nope. The other essay that I really liked was you teaching in prison.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there was a program through Auburn University. This is when I was getting my PhD, that allowed you to teach in prison, and I did. I went through that program. It's actually a state prison called Elmore Correctional Facility. I don't think I ever identified it in the essay, and maybe I'm not supposed to. I don't know, but I just did. And
we won't tell.
we won't tell. It's just the three of us, right?
You're right, right.
I taught a literature course. It was called Literature and Comedy. And the first day, I had a ton of students show up. And then I think they realized that I wasn't funny, and so there were only a few students. They thought this was, when they heard there was going to be a class on comedy, I think they thought this was going to be just kind of stand up or something. But we were instead reading everything from Shakespeare to Beckett to Oscar Wilde, and examining comedy as a genre. And yes, humor is a part of that genre, but it's not. It's not stand-up comedy. It's not yuck humor. In fact, one of the sort of darker days of class was when I decided to teach Waiting for Godot, and I'm not really sure why I decided to teach that book in prison. For those who aren't familiar with the plot, basically you have two characters that are sitting there waiting for Godot, who never comes. And I had one of the prisoners pull me aside after class and say, "Hey, you know, I appreciate what you're trying to do. You're trying to show us that there are different types of comedy, but that one was just a little bit too much for those of us who have to actually live in here, you know, because we are waiting for Godot, and Godot mm-hmm. just never comes." And that affected me. That was a powerful moment. So if I ever taught the class again, I probably would not teach that that play. But at the same time, maybe the fact that that prisoner came and pulled me aside to tell me that showed that, you know, he got something out of the book. You know, mm-hmm. literature is meant to be powerful. It's meant to have an effect on you. And clearly it had an effect on him. So maybe the play did what it was supposed to do. That's a Samuel Beckett play. It's sort of existential and very philosophically complex, in my opinion.
It sounds like, you know, in the essay you were fairly nervous going in.
I was. The first couple of classes especially, in particular the first class. But then, you know, I sort of got a groove, and I don't remember if I mentioned this in the essay or not, but I showed up one day to teach, and there's like a little holding cell. I call it a holding cell. I don't know what it really was, but it's just a little sort of cinder block room, and you're the only person in it. But it was the room that I had to go through in order to get into the yard, and the yard led to the chapel, which is where the class was. So I got through the security and to the security past the guards and everything, and then I was in that little holding room waiting for them to open the door to let me into the yard, and they never did. And I was teaching Shakespeare's Twelfth Night on that occasion, and I sat in that room for about 3.5 or 4 hours.
Whoa.
Having no idea what was going on outside, why I was in there, should I go and knock on the door, what do you do in prison, is it okay to like try to open the door, am I on camera? I didn't know. You don't know anything like that. So I just sat there and figured that somebody knew I was in there, because you have to sign in and leave your ID at the front. But I found out later, the next week, that, in fact, I do talk about this essay. Now I remember that I do talk about that. But the students in the class told me, well, what happened is there had been a stabbing. And that had happened about the time, I guess, I showed up. And so the prison went on lockdown, and I just was stuck in this holding room waiting.
Well, eventually they let you out, right?
I'm sorry?
Eventually they
let me out. I'm not calling from there, so I'm out. But, it was just kind of a strange thing. And what was interesting to me about that experience, among other things, was that the students were so apologetic the next class. They were embarrassed that it had happened, and it was as though the experience were a reflection upon them. And I did get that sense during that class that a lot of them wanted to show me that they weren't bad people. You know, we're, you know, they, it was like they wanted to prove something to me. And I never quite knew what to make of that. I mean, part of the reason I wrote the essay was to try to figure out, why did I do that? Why did I teach in prison? It's clearly not something that, you know, you add to your resume that makes you get your next job. So that couldn't have been it. You know, wasn't really the career thing I got in. Why would I do that? Was I just curious? Was this a bad impulse to have? Was I being something of a voyeur or just trying to go in there and figure out what life is like behind bars where you can't escape? Or was I trying truly to help people? And I think it was a little bit of all those. You know, it's tough to reduce intents and purposes to one thing. I mean, if we're being honest, I think we're all just swirling with contradictions and multiple reasons for the things we do, and it's hard to say that there is just one thing. And I think that's true about my experience in prison. I think there were probably multiple competing reasons for doing it, and the reason I wrote the essay was just try to tease those out and make sense of them and really see if there was something that I could get out of the experience. I mean, I, in that respect, maybe teaching was something of a selfish thing. I wanted to learn something. I wanted to get something out of it, and I think I did. But if you ask me now what I got out of it, it may be something different than what I'd say in 5 years, and it may be something different from what I would have said 3 years ago. Because I just think that we are all evolving in our views, and you know, there's, of course, all memory is selective and partial anyway. So,
well, Alan, it's interesting.
The limitation of memory.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because I had a conversation, I'm trying to remember who it was with, just a few days ago, about charitable acts. If they're done for selfish reasons, does that make them less good?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. It's one that Emerson addresses in Self-Reliance. I'm a big fan of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he sort of suggests that the answer is no to that question. But I mean, motives are really where the answer to that lies, and we can't know the motives of other people, so it does make that an interesting and perplexing question.
It does, and of course, in our legal system, intent has a big impact on the punishment that we feel is appropriate depends on intent.
I agree, and especially in criminal. I mean, in criminal law, you have four elements to a crime. You've got actus rea, mens rea, causation, and then damages. So the first one is actus rea. Did you actually do the physical thing that caused the person to die? Then mens rea, that's the intent element. Mm. So that's the more philosophical element. That's where you ask if this person is morally blameworthy. Did this person mean to kill somebody? So if I'm walking down the street with a box full of daggers and I trip and they go flying out and kill somebody, well, I can't be guilty of, you know, cold-blooded murder. It's got to be something else. It's got to be homicide because I wasn't morally blameworthy. And then the question of punishment is a big philosophical question. What punishment is proportionate to that crime? What takes it too far because I didn't mean to do it? I mean, these are big questions that we've always argued about and thought about and never perfected. I don't think we'll ever be able to perfect them because I think that we're all sort of flawed in our own ways and that the human mind is fallible and we'll never get to the right answers. But it's good for us to always be trying
to keep arguing about it. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Alan Mendenhall, author of Bees and Boys, Lines from a Southern Lawyer. It's a book of essays. And actually, this leads into one of your other essays about studying what you call the permanent things. And this is the history of ideas as expressed mostly in books, literature, philosophy. And the truth of the fact that even ideas that people think are new have probably been discussed and debated for centuries, even millennia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yeah, I think that's true. And this may also be a little bit of Emerson coming through in my thinking, because Emerson sort of had this idea that that history consists of a tradition of revision, that we are always receptive to the influence of others, and then we are using that influence to carve out new spaces for our own creativity. I know Emerson said once that what are called the new views here in New England are not new, but the oldest thoughts cast in the mold of new times. It's like the idea of old wine being poured into new wineskins. Mm-hmm. And I know elsewhere he said, let the breath of new life be breathed by you through the forms already existing. So that there's this idea that there are perennial themes and traditions and forms that are inherited, and that our role in the present is to repurpose those or reframe them or put our own spin on them for our own generation in light of new technologies, new circumstances, new urgencies and complications. And that when we do that, we are actually being faithful to a tradition, because the tradition itself is both innovating and renovating all the time. Mm. And that therefore we are carving out new room for somebody to do the same thing in the future. We don't know what new circumstances will face future authors, but we can at least give them something from our own time and space to work with, so that they can harness their own originating powers to create new art, new writing, and new literature.
Well, Alan, we're almost out of time. I do want to refer listeners to your website, alanmendenhall.com, and that's Alan, A-L-L-E-N, M-E-N-D-E-N-H-A-L-L.com. And your book is available, I'm assuming, at places where books are sold, which is mostly...
Yes, it's available in bookstores, both online and physical. Amazon.com, you can find this book as well as my other books. I've got another book coming out actually later this month.
Ooh.
And that's on the author John William Corrington. It's actually an edition, a collection of his essays. But you can find those on my website as well. I have a tab that will link to my books, and that will take you to Amazon, and you can buy them through my website as well. But Barnes & Noble has them, and many other online booksellers have picked them up.
Wow. Well, thanks, Alan. And if you missed part of this and want to catch the rest of it, we're rebroadcasting Monday morning if you're listening on Friday.
Yes, tell your friends.
Monday morning, 8 a.m. Yeah. And we'll, Writers' Voices is Fridays 1 to 2, Monday 8 to 9. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. It is not required that you be perfect in order to help others.
Ah, that is a very, very good point. All right, see you next. Stay tuned now for Planet
Earth. No one is perfect, so that's a good one.
Stay tuned for Planet Earth's Wild, and see you next week on Writers' Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.